A word of caution before you start listening. Your stomach will growl, your mouth will water, your taste buds will dance, and you'll be very hungry by the end of this episode. But that's a good thing, because your kitchen awaits you. Okay, here we go. I'm Kevin Power, and this is Sascapes, the podcast featuring stories of arts, culture, and heritage in Saskatchewan. This episode of Sascapes is sponsored by the Saskatchewan German Council. The Saskatchewan German Council is a provincial nonprofit umbrella organization to nearly 40 member groups, representing all people of German-speaking backgrounds. By engaging people of all ages to become active and involved partners in a vibrant multicultural community, the SGC is committed to the preservation and promotion of the German language, traditions, and culture for all people of Saskatchewan. You'll find the link to their website in the show notes. This is the third in a series of special Sascapes podcast presents entitled German Culture Alive, all sponsored by the SGC. You can hear the first two in this series. Listen to episode 93 and 95. They say that food and family go hand in hand. Well, for this episode of Sascapes, I had some help with editing, courtesy of a member of my family, my nephew Matt Power of Power Web Media. Matt has over 20 years' experience in sound recording and editing. So, if you have a podcast of your own that could use some editing or cleaning up, you can find more at powerwebmedia.com. I'll include a link to Matt's website in the show notes. I just want to take a minute to let you know, dear listeners, that Sascapes is made possible thanks to a great deal of support around the province. So please stay tuned all the way to the end of this episode for some very important messages from some of the people that help make Sascapes happen. No matter how you're listening to Sascapes, please don't forget your comments, reviews, and star ratings are always welcome. I'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to email directly, you can contact me at sascapes@icloud.com. Okay, my guest describes herself as an author, freelance writer, and pie maker. She grew up surrounded by pigs, chickens, big gardens, and the wide open wheat fields of her family farm at Crake, Saskatchewan. Amy Jo Amon followed her heart and stomach to the farm, across the province and deep into the agricultural heartland of Canada, to the down-home cooking of her childhood and the bounty of Saskatchewan. Amy Jo's farming ancestors came to Canada from Russia in the 1890s, and ever since she was a child, she dreamed of visiting their village. Well, that opportunity came a few years ago, and in this episode, Amy Jo paints a really vivid picture of what that visit was like. The historical part of our conversation really continues with the conversation I had with Merv Weiss in episode 95, so if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and have a listen sometime. Okay, this is Amy Jo Amon. Amy Jo, thank you for joining me on my humble little podcast series. It's nice to finally get to talk with you versus just exchanging tweets.
It's fun to be here. I love to talk about food, so
and
I'm happy.
Coincidentally enough, so do I. So this ought to work out just peachy keen. So I'm going to ask first how your pandemic's going, but I'm going to preface that question by reading a quote from your January blog on your website and find out if that's where you're at now and if that pretty much is accurate. You say, it's a brand new year, but I'm not feeling too perky about it. Where did the last year go? It feels like the pandemic lockdown has sucked all the good vibes and turned them into molasses. Molasses? I hardly even feel like baking. Now that's a sorry state of affairs. Does that truly sum up your pandemic year so far?
That certainly summed up my January. I feel a little more hopeful now that January has turned to February. I've started baking again. So I think things are looking up. Spring's on the way, but I kept my spirits up through the holiday season. I did a lot of baking, but come January, I just wanted to hibernate.
Yeah, I think everybody felt that way. Although the media feed on your Twitter account would suggest otherwise, because I see all kinds of goodies that you've been baking. I'm just looking. February the 5th is your most recent recipe for a chocolate cake. But I know that the other day you baked a bun, so it must be going okay.
It's a sign that my mental well-being is coming back to me, that you see me baking again and throwing it out there on my Twitter and my social feeds.
Did you just kind of flatline on the whole baking thing when the pandemic hit, because the joy of baking for you is baking for other people and everybody in lockdown, you can't take stuff everywhere? And
you know, I would say not, because I baked a lot during the early times of this pandemic lockdown, because it was something I love to do and I'm at home anyways. And I was giving a lot of it away because it's just my husband and me and we can't eat all that. And yes, we did put on our pandemic pounds, but it would have been a lot more if I had not been sharing some of the goodies that I had been cooking. And I cooked a lot through the Christmas season. I think it just was a New Year thing. I think I just needed to, you know, crawl inside a little bit when the year started, just to take stock, just to be quiet, just to ease up on the baking and the sugar and everything, and just kind of sit still for a little while, for a month. So like I say, now that it's getting a little brighter, the days are a little bit longer, I'm starting to bake a little bit more, and I'm coming back out of my little lair and coming back into the world. So yeah, you'll probably be seeing more food posts on my social feeds in the days and weeks to come.
I don't mind. I have to say they make my mouth water, and that's a good thing to be able to look at.
That's good.
Yeah. What did you make of the whole flour yeast shortage back in early 2020 when this first started? You couldn't find baking ingredients everywhere. What did that say to you about people's headspace around baking?
I thought that was marvelous. I didn't get caught by it. I had just purchased a fresh bag of flour and I was rich with yeast, and a friend who had some yeast that he wasn't using just voluntarily offered it to me. So I was flush with that when we started out. So I was not one of those persons who had to run out to the store and stock up and find shelves empty, thank goodness. It was one reason why I was baking for other people, bread and that sort of thing, because people were at home eating more meals at home and maybe short on some of those ingredients themselves. So it was a good excuse for me to do more than I needed for myself and share it with others. But I think I love the trend. I love the idea. And everybody trying sourdough off the start, I'm not sure if they're still with it, but I think it was marvelous that people wanted to give that a go because they were at home and they felt like they had the time for it. And the other trend, if you want to call it that, I hope it's not trendy, but so many people were interested more in the foods of the place where they live. They were shopping more locally. They were doing more research. When they were doing takeout, more people were trying to take out from those restaurants that were cooking off the local bounty. It was a nice thing to see. So those were some of the benefits of being at home and having more time to cook for oneself and the necessity of cooking for oneself, because we were not eating out at restaurants so much, especially when the sun started. So those are some of the positive things that if we are looking for positives that we can state about this time, I think that was among them.
Yeah, I think it's very curious that in many ways the whole idea of returning to your local ingredients and returning to your kitchen rather than ordering out, there's something very, very throwback to that. I mean, there was a time when that's what you did as part of your daily routine, and you didn't have the distraction of Twitter and Facebook and social media and all that stuff, and there was a lot more baking going on. So it was interesting to see all of that external stuff stripped away somewhat and people sort of returned to their roots. I thought it was kind of cool. I must admit, I kind of got suckered into buying every bag of flour I could get my hands on, because my mom's a ferocious baker. And so now we have a real stockpile of flour, because no human being should have that much flour, and we'll never make it through all that flour. But I know that shopping locally and eating locally is something that's really important to you. You grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan, yes?
Yes, I did. My hometown is Crake, and my brother's on the farm now with his kids.
Ah, the town of Crake. We stopped once in Crake, and I remarked on the cemetery that's sort of right there as you turn in.
Yeah, right by the highway when you come into town.
Yeah, yeah. I would say growing up, I have not grown up on a farm. I grew up on the East Coast in fishing country, but I would think you're very close to food and cooking and animals and the land when you grow up on a farm. So is that really where your passion and love of food first began, just from having that experience in your formative years?
My formative years were definitely play a role in it, because growing up on the farm, when I did, a lot of those foodways were still practiced, and we ate off our gardens and our animals, and things were done kind of, maybe you might even say, the old-fashioned way. Well, you know what, I'm not going to date myself so much. We weren't churning our own butter and that sort of thing, but you know, we produced a lot of our own food, and home cooking was the way to go. But you know, I went to university, I studied journalism, and I worked in newsrooms, and here in Saskatoon, I was like the career girl, and like everyone else, I was just shopping out of the grocery store. But there came a point in my life where I was triggered. It's like I was triggered for those flavors from my childhood, and I really wanted to get back to that. And particularly, I thought, to do that, I have to source my ingredients locally, because it's that local flavor. It's that homegrown, unprocessed flavor that I really remembered from my childhood. So I started purchasing everything that I could locally and sourcing it. And it was more than 10 years ago. Now I'm going to date myself. This is more than 15 years ago. But it wasn't so easy to shop locally. We didn't have so many shops that were offering things, and farmers weren't having their own websites, and there wasn't e-commerce like there is today. So it was more of a job to do it back then. But that's kind of what got me really going. It was a challenge. It was a hunt. It was a search to find those foods and buy them and bring them into my house. And it was the subject of my first couple of books as well, because it was a thing that I was loving at the time and wanting to write about and share with others.
I've got your Out of Old Saskatchewan Kitchens book right in front of me. Find it wherever you get your books, on Amazon, I'm guessing, Indigo probably, Saskatoon Library.
Wherever.
Yes. Okay. You can be found. And you write in that book that whenever you think of apples, you think of your grandma.
Mm-hmm. I sure do. I think of my German grandma, Eman, my dad's mom. And growing up on the farm, we had apple trees of various different kinds of apples, crab apples and larger yellow apples, pie apples and plums as well. But I think of my, when I think of gardening, I think of my grandma and I think of the apples that she used in cooking. It's just one of those flavors that I think I must have been an early flavor in my mouth as a toddler, and I associate it with my grandma, applesauce cookies, apple kuchen, and that sort of thing, and even just eating sour apples. I'm still such a sourpuss for the apples from the farm. So I think, yeah, that's the association. My earliest association with my grandma is garden and apples, cooking with apples.
There's a couple of varieties of apples, because I'm a huge apple fan, that you can't get in Saskatchewan that I grew up with. And one is the Cortland apple, and the other one is a russet apple. And those are the apple memories that I have. Although there's something undeniable about a good old Mac, I have to say.
Yeah, and you know what? The apples that we grew on the farm, I don't even know if they had names. What apples will actually survive a winter like we've been experiencing here in early this year, you know, right now that we've just been living through minus 30, minus 40, you know, the apples that will survive that are a hardy breed.
Right.
And so, you know, you just hang on to those ones, and so many other varieties just won't grow here.
So I wanted to talk to you. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. You were one of the first people that I reached out to on Twitter when I got back to Saskatchewan. But I had a great podcast session with Merv Weiss in episode 95. And at the end of it, I picked up the phone and contacted Gabrielle at the Saskatchewan German Council and said, I really want to follow up that conversation and have Amy Jo on the series, because we had spoken a lot about Germans living in Russia, which I know is part of your heritage.
It's my dad's side of the family is German, and both my grandma and my grandpa on that side were German families living in Russia, had settled in Russia before they came to Canada.
Now, were you aware of that? Were you aware of your heritage growing up? Was that something talked about often?
Yes, absolutely. I was definitely aware of my heritage while I was growing up. In fact, other branches, other lines of my family, I wasn't quite so well aware of. But that the Eamon side of my family and its connections to Russia, something that we learned as youngsters. And at some point in the 60s, when I was just a kid, someone in our family put together a family tree, and that was a book. It's probably like an inch and a half thick of all the Eamon families that mostly in Saskatchewan. And I poured through that book looking for friends and cousins and just trying to make connections and things. So it's something I have personally been interested in since I was very young. And now as an adult, it's so, these times right now, it's so much easier to follow up on these things. Merv is someone that I know of and have been involved with in trying to follow up on some of this research that you can now access, and you can post it online. You can find so much more now about your heritage, and particularly your heritage if your background is German from Russia. But I'm so into it because it's always been a keen interest of mine.
And you had this childhood dream to actually travel to the area where your family grew up. You went in 2015. Was that when you went with your husband?
Yeah, I think it was 15 or 16. I went back to the village that my dad's, both maternal and paternal family, both way back through my dad's side. They came from a region in, so it's now Ukraine. So I went back to Ukraine to visit this village. But at the time that they lived there in the 1800s, it was considered part of Russia. And so the village names have changed. Back in the day that my family lived there, there were three German villages side by side. They were called Klosterdorf, Mühlhausendorf, and Schreigendorf. They are now, they don't have German names anymore. Now they have a Ukrainian name, and it's called Zemyevka. So that's the village that I went back to, was Zemyevka. There was a fourth village there. Actually, the very first village there was Swedish. The very first settlers who settled there were Swedish ancestry. And so those four villages all together now fall under the name of Zemyevka. And they maintain some of their Swedish ancestry, but their Swedish feel, but most of the German elements of that village are long gone, because in the First and Second World Wars, Germany and Russia were mortal enemies. So any Germans who are still living there left at that time, or found their fates, not unhappy fates for still being there. And I think Merv talked about that in your podcast a little bit. But anyway, my family left there well before any of those world wars, when it was still very German. But you know, it's not very German anymore. But I still loved going back and seeing the place. It was just amazing, amazing to go back to one's ancestral village like that, even if you can't speak the language and you don't know exactly which house your family lived in. But just to, you know, the houses that are there and the layout of the streets is exactly the same. So other than the fact that there's motor cars and little tractors running around now, it's probably hasn't changed all that much in a century.
So what kind of foods did you find there when you went to visit? Was it the more traditional Germanic foods, or did you still see evidence of some of the Swedish influence there when you went back to eat? Hey, it's Kevin. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just a quick reminder that the Sascapes podcast is available for free on your favorite podcast app, or you can stream it from your browser. Check out the show notes for the link. On the Sascapes homepage, you'll notice something new under the logo called Sascapes Plus. You can't miss it. There's a big button saying support with a heart icon next to it. I'd love it if you could click on that button and help keep this podcast series going. When Sascapes launched in May 2014, it was the first podcast in the province celebrating arts, culture, and heritage. In fact, you'd have been pretty hard-pressed to find any Saskatchewan podcasts. So I'd like to think that we paved the way. It's been because of your support that this podcast is now in its 9th year. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
I would say no Germanic influences really at all, unless perhaps you went to an ethnic restaurant claimed to be German, of which I saw none, so I don't even know if there is such a thing. It is Ukraine, and it has been Ukraine since, the country of Ukraine, since there have been Ukrainians living there since before that, but the actual country of Ukraine since the 20s, or the Soviet Republic it was at that time, since the 20s. And so, and the place where my village is quite east. It's Black Sea. It's way east of Odessa. It's on the Dnieper River. So it's not close to what we would call Western Europe, where a lot of the Germans from Russia who came to Canada, they lived more closer to what is now Central Europe, closer to Germany, closer to Romania, and you know, along that Polish border where Ukraine is the border between Ukraine and the rest of Europe now. So my family was further east from that. They were far from Germany even when they lived there. So I imagine that when they moved there, their foods changed already. They moved there around 1804, 1805, they would have found themselves in a place that didn't have, their food traditions would have had to change then. I don't think that some of their German foods that they might have been familiar with back home in the Black Forest, they wouldn't have been able to recreate them and carry them on once they moved to the Black Sea region of of what was then South Russia. So when you talk about my German food heritage, it's gone through two transformations. First of all, around like early 1800s, they went from Germany to South Russia near the Black Sea. And then in the 1890s, they went from the Black Sea area to Canada. And so it transformed again. Once again, they brought what they remembered, but then they could only cook what they could find the ingredients for here in Saskatchewan, or what became Saskatchewan. So it's certainly, even in my own family, there isn't like this pure German cuisine like it, that I would find, and I wouldn't expect to find that kind of cuisine in that part of what is Ukraine and formerly part of Russia. It just wasn't a solid cuisine there, especially after all of the German ethnic people mostly moved away. I don't know if that's a really great explanation, but that's the way I see it.
So it was in the 1790s when Tsar Catherine the Great first invited farmers to return to that area from all over Europe, including Germans. So when the Germans arrived there, I'm guessing they had some agricultural savvy going into that journey, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In fact, one of the reasons that Catherine the Great and her successors welcomed the Germans is because they felt that the Russian peasants, or the people who lived on the land at that time, either weren't farming it because they were more pastoral, they were involved with livestock, or they were farming with more rudimentary methods. And they thought that the Germans and people from Europe had more advanced farming methods and would bring them and share them with those who were living there. But there were different waves of immigration. And so, yes, the first ones came around in the 1790s. They were not the region that I came from in Russia. So they came first. And then there was a later wave not under Catherine the Great, but under one of her successors, grandson maybe, around the early 1800s. And that's when my family ended up there. I guess the time frame isn't that different. But, you know, they went to different regions and there were different foods and different farming traditions available to them when they got there. So the area where my family went to was on the Black Sea and the Dnieper River. So fish became more a part of their diets, I'm sure, because fishing was prevalent there. But when they came to Saskatchewan, I think they lost that. I remember my grandpa going fishing, but we didn't eat fish on a regular basis once they were here, because it just wasn't probably as available as it was back when they were living in Russia.
I'd read that when the Swedes were living there, they weren't great farmers, so they tended to rely more on fish and meat and cheese, hence Swiss cheese, yeah. I suppose.
The Swedes, they were kind of well known for their cheese. I know, I'm going to back up here a little bit and say, I know a little bit about the Swedish life there as well, because there was intermarriage between the families. So I traced my ancestry back to that Swedish village as well. And from there, I traced my ancestry back to Estonia and back to Sweden. So I've also got, you know, an interest of tracing back that. So that comes through my grandmother's line because of intermarriage between the villages. And they were quite well known for their cheese. And because the Swedes who went there were not farmers. In that sense of, you know, like the part of Russia/Ukraine that my family came, looks like rural Saskatchewan. It's like these wide open plains with nary a tree on them. It is like steppe land, good dark soil farmland. Whereas the Swedes came from a Baltic island, you know, where they were, you know, raising sheep and growing enough, you know, just enough alfalfa and whatever, well, maybe not alfalfa, shouldn't say that, but hay for their animals and enough wheat for their own bread, but certainly not that kind of dry land farming like was expected to take place on those steppelands. So they weren't the most successful farmers in that sense, but they were successful in terms of livestock and cheese and fishing. Yeah, they made a life for themselves. It started out very hard for the Swedes. It's a really tragic story, but the survivors did well.
So the area where your family is from, what was the land like when the Germans first got to the area? Was it an easy agricultural experience, or were they really up against adverse soil conditions and things like that?
I think that the kind of stories they would tell, if they could, would be in some ways like the stories that could be told by the first settlers who came to Saskatchewan and found themselves on this vast, open, dry land prairie. The landscape looks the same.
Right.
The weather conditions can be the same, though maybe not quite so cold in the winter, but extremely hot. It can get hot in the summer. It can be very frosty in the winter. They didn't have the kind of farm machinery we do now. Of course, you know, pulling plows with oxen and breaking the soil and planting it. It was tough. There wasn't, like many parts of Saskatchewan, there weren't trees from which to build a house. You know, you had to build a mud hut. Even stories that you hear from both locations where the first people lived by digging themselves holes into the side of the hillside of the river valleys and stuff, and just sort of living in caves in the hillsides so that they could get through that first winter, second winter, and get to a point where they could build themselves a mud hut and, you know, at some point maybe get some wood in and build themselves a house. But I think it was very, in many ways, similar experience for my ancestors who went from Germany to Russia, as for many persons who came straight to Saskatchewan in the early days of settlement here.
Now, these are a people for whom a low-carb diet would be totally useless. So when I think of this region and the various cultures from this region, and certainly Germans being part of that, I think of potatoes and root vegetables and really hearty, hearty foods. Is that a misnomer, or is that really the staple? And is the answer as to why as obvious as that's what was plentiful and that's what sustained them in the long haul?
Yes, that latter sentence that you just said that's it. You know, those are the foods that were available to them that they could grow that would keep through the winter. Sauerkraut, you know, you ferment your cabbage and it keeps through the winter. It becomes actually more nutritious for you as sauerkraut than as raw cabbage because it's had that fermentation, but it's also rich in vitamin C. So without them having the nutritional label on it, those were healthy foods. But they were also foods that they could grow in their growing season and that they were able to keep through the winter. So potatoes, rutabagas, cabbage/sauerkraut. They grew wheat, so of course, and rye. So of course they had flours and they made breads for themselves. Dairy, you know, when I think of my grandma, I think of butter and cream. You know, there was absolutely no low-fat cooking in that sense, you know, when it comes to dairy and making full-fat foods, because that's what they had. And probably for the amount of work that they did, they needed to eat like that.
The keto diet fans will be thrilled to hear that.
That's a different
conversation altogether.
Well, yeah, because, well, the carbohydrates are not part of a keto diet.
Exactly. No, but I mean the full fat.
Mm.
You know, we fell into a culture of low fat, no fat stuff. And the full fat does sustain you longer in the end.
I'll just add to that as a modern, you know, food and eating a person in this modern world, I never bought into any low fat, no fat I just never bought it. I never bought that nutritional message. So it just, I never went down that route. I never didn't eat eggs.
You know? Right, right.
I always thought they were good food.
Right.
A part of that is my upbringing. You know, those are the foods I was raised on. I was healthy when I was raised on them. I'm still healthy for eating them. I don't think there's was good reason for me to give that up for some nutritional message that I thought just wasn't maybe really quite accurate.
Where did things like pulses and grains fit into their diet? I know that next to Russia, Saskatchewan is the largest producer of oats. Is that right?
Yeah, Saskatchewan is the second largest producer of oats in the world next to Russia. And I like to add, and Russia is a lot bigger.
Right.
But we grow a lot of oats here in Saskatchewan. You know, when you go to, and Manitoba is also a very large producer of oats, though not the acreage as in Saskatchewan. So a lot of the oat products that you go to the grocery store and you pick up, whether it's just rolled oats or granola bars, you know, the oats, very good chance, good percentage chance the oats originated in Saskatchewan.
Oh, that blog that you wrote in January, you had acquired a 50-pound bag of oats, I see. Still working your way through that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, thank goodness it's cold outside because there's no way that's going to fit in my fridge.
Right.
And those and grains, natural grains like that, whether it's natural flours or naturally rolled oats, if they have not been processed, and by that I mean treated, pre-cooked, treated in some way, they need to be kept cold.
So with the Germans living in the area where you grew up, they would have had access to grains like oats? And what about legumes and pulses and things like that?
Where I grew up in Saskatchewan, yeah, definitely my dad grew oats. I remember that. So yeah, and oatmeal porridge was something I grew up with, although pulses, particularly lentils and chickpeas, that was not something that was grown to any extent at all in Saskatchewan until, you know, more like in the last 20 years or so, maybe 30 years, it's become more prevalent here. But definitely, but in terms of pulses, you know, garden pulses like peas and beans, we had those. But
what about your ancestors? Would they have had access to those?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they had peas and beans and things, if not on the scale of farms, definitely in their gardens. I think the gardens of those villages in Russia and now Ukraine, the gardens are amazing. The gardens are very, very prolific. People are very prolific and diligent gardeners, even, well, to this day, and I'm sure they were back then as well.
The sugar beet has a very interesting history.
Yes, and I think the whole sugar beet, it is an interesting story because, and it ties in with Napoleon, and don't ask me what battle or what era, but as the story goes, Napoleon was losing some access because of blockades by Britain. Like the sugar cane coming from the Caribbean islands was not making it to France in the quantities that the French were used to eating. And so he announced that it was a prize, it was a contest if anyone could come up with an alternate form of sugar. And some people, agronomists, knew that sugar beets had a high content of sugar. So the idea was at that point to develop a way of growing it on a large scale and processing the sugar out of it. So somebody won a prize for that and was a national hero in France. So I'm not saying the French invented it, but definitely Napoleon popularized it.
Were there foods that were so unique to that region that when the first immigrants came to Saskatchewan, they were introducing something that was quite new to the general diet of people who had already lived here?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, to tell you the honest truth. So, settlers came from so many different cultures and parts of Europe and beyond to settle in Saskatchewan when they came. And although they came from different food cultures originally, when they got here, they all had the same set of ingredients.
Yeah.
So they used their knowledge of recipes with the ingredients that they had on hand. So you find a lot of the old recipes. It has the thing that made it culturally significant for one ethnic group over the other was maybe in the process of baking it, in the shape in which it was baked, what spice was put into it, what name they gave it, when they ate it. But they all started with the same basic ingredients. And this is part of the early Saskatchewan story that I find so fascinating, is that people clung to their traditional ethnic dishes as best they could, despite the fact that they didn't probably have most of the ingredients that they really needed to do those things here in Saskatchewan. So it would be no different for the Germans that came from Russia as it would be for Norwegians who came from Norway or Scottish from Scotland. You know, they tried to do what they could. But then, and you know, going one step further from that, they would put their twist onto the ingredients that are available here. So one of the things that from Eastern Europe and my ancestors that I think when I look back on it is poppy seeds, you know, poppy seed buns and putting poppy seeds in cookies and that sort of thing. So that's not something that perhaps, you know, people from other parts of Europe that settled here were as big on poppy seeds as those from Eastern Europe were. And I remember my grandma's garden was on the farm, just so many poppies and big poppies, so that you would get that when the flowers dropped off, you got that big hard shaker with the seeds, like hundreds of seeds in it, right? So that was a little thing that she could do that spoke to her heritage and her remembrance of baking that someone else from some other cultural heritage might not have done.
And that's what I find fascinating about the foods from all of these regions and these cultures coming together, is that you're right, there are so many identical dishes. And as you say, there may be different tweaks, different spices that are thrown in, different, maybe different ways of preparing it, the end result being quite similar, that have very, very different names. My background on my mom's side is Russian Jewish. And, you know, when I think of the foods that I was introduced growing up, you know, things like Vareniki, they would call them. And I think, do the Ukrainians call, because no, the Vareniki are the pierogies, right?
Vareniki is the Ukrainian word. Pierogi is the Russian word. Maybe some Polish, I think in Polish they call them pierogi. So, but Vareniki is the Ukrainian word. When I was in Ukraine and going to the grocery stores, you could buy Vareniki in frozen Vareniki in bulk, in the bulk bin, you know. So pierogis, but called Vareniki, are still very, obviously very much part of Ukrainian cuisine. But whether you called them Vareniki or pierogi, they're pretty much the same thing.
I find that whole subject quite fascinating, that there's so much crossover and so many different names for the identical recipes. Was there a cross-cultural exchange within the many cultures that wound up here in Saskatchewan? I mean, did people start to intermingle and realize they were more alike than different when it came to the foods that they ate?
Absolutely, there was cross-cultural mingling because they were tasting each other's foods. And I don't know a cook who doesn't taste something and that she loves or he loves and says, oh my gosh, can I have the recipe for that? You know, so of course there was that kind of cross-cultural mingling in the early days. And not just because it tasted good, but also out of necessity. So for instance, those persons who came from parts of the world where making sauerkraut was not something, was not part of their culinary tradition, they learned it pretty quick when they came here, because that was for some parts of the year, your sauerkraut was your only green vegetable, if you want to call it that at that point, but that was the only vegetable on your table other than, say, potatoes in the middle of winter, like when it's minus 30 and you've got there's no access to anything fresh, and you can't run out and buy something. So it was something like sauerkraut definitely was shared between cultures here. I imagine other things like that were too, because communities came together for their fall suppers, church picnics, school picnics, and people would have tried dishes that others made. And because all the ingredients were pretty much available, it was just a matter of learning a different way of putting it together. So it wasn't really hard to do. If you liked somebody's cookies or somebody's cake and you asked them for a recipe, that ethnic touch might come into your family, even though it wasn't part of your heritage.
Where did meat fall into place within the diet once they got to Saskatchewan, or before they got to Saskatchewan? I mean, these were, you know, we know from our First Nations and Métis people that drying meat was a way of prolonging its shelf life. Was that something practiced within German cuisine culture?
If we go by what I recall from my childhood, when my grandparents were still around and participating, I'm going to say no. I don't recall really drying food. I think they kind of came from a culture more with salting. They were brining and salting, salt pork or canning canned chickens. Although I have to say, I don't know if they did much canning back in Russia in the 1800s. I don't know. But I know canning was a big part of their larder once they got to Canada, because that was a way of saving all sorts of foods, including meat, to be able to eat it in the wintertime. I think that from my feeling is... back in Russia, the Germans who were living in Russia had, they all had a milk cow, and you wouldn't have eaten your cow, right? Because it mm-hmm. was giving you milk. Mm-hmm. So, and you would have had an oxen, like a cattle, but they weren't raised for a good steak on the Barbie. They were work animals in many ways. So they were pulling the plow. And so probably the more prevalent meat on the tables on a more regular basis was probably pork, like pigs. Mm-hmm. Pigs are an easier animal to raise, and they eat anything, so they're good to have. And chickens, right. Because you have eggs. So this is very similar, though, to how people... the first settlers lived in rural Saskatchewan as well. You know, you got yourself a milk cow, and then so that you at least had butter and milk for your children, and then you added to the livestock in your family, and you only ate meat when it was okay to kill it. And because there was no freezers, you couldn't really do it until, I remember in my own family, we still did the butchering in late fall, early winter. So it's those cold days, but not snow on the ground yet. That way, you know, you're not worrying about meat going bad, but you're able to process it and put it away at a time when it's going to be frozen. And so you can keep it longer. So those kinds of considerations, you know, in that sense, what that kind of knowledge about folk ways and food ways was probably very similar for my Russian ancestors, my German Russian ancestors from when they were in Russia.
And what about fish?
Yeah, and I think fish was probably more of their diet when they were in Russia, because they lived on a big river and the Black Sea, so there was more fish. And because they moved into the region where the Swedish people were already living, and they were very proficient. I know that the Swedish people taught my ancestors how to fish, because that wasn't so much part of their German heritage, fishing. And so they learned how to fish from their Swedish neighbors when they moved to Russia, and then they would have brought that to Saskatchewan. I know fishing was a big part of, there were summer fishing excursions, but we had to go somewhere to fish. You know, when you live on the flat prairies, you don't always have a fishing spot nearby. Eventually, my German ancestors settled in around the area of Holfast, Saskatchewan, so very close to Long Lake, and I know fishing was an important part of the lifestyle of those early farmers, early families along Long Lake. So I think the fish was an important part for them once they came to Canada when they could get it.
Is there an equivalent of pickled herring within German culture?
I'm sure there is, because there's many Germans who live near the sea and good fishing, but it's not something that transferred through my family that I'm aware of in their various migrations from the Black Forest to the Black Sea to Saskatchewan.
Are there any foods that over time have been dropped or just not made as much or eaten as much? Have we sort of gotten absorbed into so many different cultures that it's morphed into some things that just simply you never hear talked about anymore?
Yeah, I'm not really sure, because various families have their own traditions, and I wouldn't want to say something isn't made anymore, because someone will put their hand up and go, oh yeah, we still do that. So I don't really want to say anything is being dropped if it's still being cooked by some, or is still being able to be found in recipe books that people can pick up and do it. Although definitely our ways of cooking have changed, and you sort of touched on this earlier when you were talking about the low-fat diets and that sort of thing. So, you know, lard, which was such a big part of, think of the cuisine of making pies and just using lard as a fat, you know, deep frying in lard, you know, making your donuts in lard and using it as a cooking fat. That's definitely not so much part of our cuisine, is it? Right.
Right.
You know, today. So now I am able to buy. So the first time I was in that time of my life where I was really trying to source all my foods locally from local sources, and I was able to get fresh rendered lard from a farm, and I used it to make a pie, and it was revelatory. I just took a bite of this pie and I thought, that is my grandma's pie. It tastes different. It brings a different taste to the dish, to the recipe. And it was like an epiphany for me. It's like, if I'm going to make a pie, this is the lard I want to use in it, because this is the pie that my grandmother made. But that's just not really available to most people now, or they have to go out of their way to find that kind of a farm-made, homemade lard now. So that's definitely a food that's gone by the wayside.
Well, my mom would definitely agree with you, because she's a great pie maker as well. And I know it's not locally sourced from a farm, but I do know a couple of places where you can actually buy lard. And you're right, it's a eyes rolling in the back of the head experience of taste bud sensations, having crusts made from lard versus shortening and tender flake and stuff like that. And actually, the nutritional profile of lard, there's many dietitians who say it's actually much better for you. The fats are much better for you than stuff like tender flake. Sorry, tender flake, I don't mean to deter you from being a sponsor of the podcast or anything,
but Tenderflake, is a lard product, although obviously processed. But something like Crisco is not a meat, is not a lard product at all. It is a vegetable product. And so I think that definite processing is going into turning a vegetable oil into a Crisco. You know, I'm not saying don't use it. I'm saying I won't. But
yeah,
I'm trying to make the pies with my grandmother.
A couple of podcasts ago, we did a podcast with members of the German community on Christmas traditions. And of course, food played a huge part in that. Do you have anything to say about Christmas foods?
You know, in my family, when it came to Christmas desserts, it was Saskatoon berry pie. So that's something we've adopted from Saskatchewan. It wasn't a German tradition at all. But I'm trying to think. I listened to that podcast. It really, you know, Germans have such wonderful traditions that just didn't pass down through my family. Because like I say, through the migrations from Germany to Russia and then Russia to Canada, some of those things just didn't travel. For instance, there's such a tradition now in Germany, a long tradition in Germany of gingerbread. And that wasn't so much a tradition in my family. And I think it's probably because those spices just didn't travel with us, you know, in our migrations. Now I love gingerbread and, you know, we do make it, but I don't think of it as part of my cultural heritage, at least not the part that passed through Russia.
Glühwein? Did glühwein even make it to your table?
I know what that is, but no, that wasn't a real tradition for me as well. No. We do have food traditions, though maybe not necessarily associated with Christmas per se, but we do have some things that came down through the centuries. For instance, you know, my grandmother made cake, like a coffee cake, and gosh, I just wish I had her recipe because I can't quite repeat it, although I keep trying it, but we called it Kuga. Mm-hmm. We called it Kuga, like K-O-O-G-A. I'm not even sure how you would how you would write that. But of course, the German word for cake is Kuka.
Right.
But somehow through the translations of the moving around and coming here, and I don't know, maybe it was, we called it Kuga. And it was like, it wasn't that long ago that I actually, this light bulb went off in my head and I said, oh, Kuga. Mm-hmm. Kuga and Kuga, they're the same thing. But it's basically a cake that's made with yeast, and a lot of yeast baking. And I don't know if that's because sourdough was the way to go, and maybe the rising agents like a baking soda wasn't available or not, I'm guessing. But a lot of yeast desserts, even when they're not bread. So, of course, all the rolls and the buns and cakes and things that were made with yeast dough. So that's something that I associate with my grandmother. And oftentimes they're dishes. And, of course, this is big in German cuisine to do a cake that has fruit in it, whether it's apple kuchen or a plum kuchen or a cherry kuchen. But I remember mostly with my grandma that it was apples because that's the fruit that we had available to us on the farm. And so that's how she made it. So there's an absolute example of a culinary tradition that I can trace back from Russia back to my German roots, even though it's 200 years ago or more.
One of the things I love in your book is you went to the trouble of capturing some photographs of original handwritten recipes, and it's just so charming. You actually write it out sort of phonetically, how it would be pronounced, but the spelling is absolutely charming for Sinoman. I remember that being written. It's really, really charming to see that.
That was so wonderful. It was shared with me from some friends of mine, Gwen and Celine Schmidt here in Saskatoon, but their grandmother was originally Polish. And so this is an example of families, women sharing recipes with women. She tasted something from her neighbor. She wanted to know how to make it. The neighbor dictated out the recipe. The Polish lady wrote it down in English, but it's spelled phonetically using her Polish phonetics.
Yeah.
It is so charming.
Yes. It really is. So what's your favorite thing to make in general? Like, what's your go-to comfort food, for example, other than pie?
I make a lot of bread as well. So, but I'm not sure I'd call that in the category of comfort food because that's sort of a necessity for me is having bread around today, like, you know, sandwiches and that sort of thing. So there's always some bread that I'm making. And nostalgic wise, my mom was a really great maker of buns, and my mom's gone now, but every now and then I make my mom's buns because it's like, and then I've got bread and I'm memorializing my mom at the same time. I love cookies. I love the process of getting out my rolling pin, which is my grandmother's rolling pin, not my German grandmother's rolling pin, but my Irish grandmother's rolling pin.
Is it one of those long, is it one of the long, narrow ones that sort of is tapered at the end?
No, it looks like any rolling pin, except I know that it had my grandma's hands all over it. So that's what makes it special. I'd like to get one of those long ones. Yeah, I associate those more with, you know, my grandma, my German grandma, we haven't talked about noodles. My German grandma definitely made noodles, and she didn't have she had a rolling pin, but it was basically just a dowel, right? Just a long, round dowel type piece of wood that you would roll out, and she would roll this dough out on the kitchen table, and it would be like a sheet. It would be so long, it would be hanging over the table and as thin as a sheet, and she would just keep rolling until you could almost see yourself through it, you know, and then she would roll it up and slice it into broad egg noodles. So that's another aspect of German cuisine, but that's something that would travel very well from Germany to Russia back to Saskatchewan. So it's something, a part of her heritage that her family brought to Canada with them. These noodles were probably being cooked and then served with gobs of butter on them, or else they were going into a soup.
So you've got to have one thing that you think, oh my God, this is, if anybody saw me eating this, they'd die, because I'm talking so much about local stuff, like one processed guilty pleasure.
Oh, I'm sure I've got many. I'm sure. I'm not a purist.
Right. Are you offering cooking classes at all, or have you in the past?
Oh, I have a little bit in the past, but it's not really my joy.
Have you been involved with the German Pavilion at Folkfest?
No, I have not been involved with the German Pavilion at Folkfest, though I have gone, and I love German cuisine, and I love being in Germany and eating the cuisine, but and I lay claim to it because my heritage is in Germany, but I don't personally come from that in
right.
Like for 5-6 generations, maybe 7 generations. I am that far removed from Germany because my family's migrations from Germany to Russia and then to Canada. So I don't feel like I can lay claim to that aspect, to be, you know, involved with the German Pavilion, because I'm, like I say, I'm quite removed from that. Although I have also been, we spoke earlier how I had gone to my ancestral village in Ukraine, which was in Russia at the time that my ancestors lived there. And I've also been to the village in Germany that my ancestors lived in before they went to Russia. So that was fun. So that, you know, that's where you can get a good pretzel and various pastries and things that I really associate with Germany.
You had an interpreter, Victoria, when you went on your trip. Didn't you meet an elderly gentleman who was asking about why you were taking the trip? And when you told him, he looked and sort of squinted and said, ah, yes, he could see the family resemblance.
He looked at me and he said, I can see it in your face. I can't remember exactly. It wasn't like a particular family resemblance, but he definitely said, I can see it in your face. Definitely. He looked at me like, oh, yeah, it's there. I really appreciated that.
Did you find any relatives that you've connected with that you didn't know you had?
No, I did not. And it's partly, well, mostly because of, and I think, and Merv discussed this in your podcast with him, and we kind of were mentioning earlier that no ethnic Germans live there anymore, unless, if they do, they were probably married into Russian, Ukrainian, Swedish families. They don't bear German sounding surnames anymore because of the conflicts, wars and conflicts in Europe over that century. The Germans just left that area. You can go online and find the number of German families from my village who were sent to the Gulag. some who were murdered for anti-communist activities. So those who did not leave, those who did not come to Canada, they had a hard time of it, and life was not easy for many of them. And some of them left quite late. Some of them left in the 40s. So this is sort of a long way of saying I didn't expect to find German ancestors there. In fact, I found very little evidence of German culture there at all. Yeah. And one way I have been exploring them is through my own ancestry and my own genealogy, as I sort of trace back family lines to different places. So one of my winter projects through COVID, because I'm inside a lot and I needed a project to bring joy into my life, as I decided to explore my Swedish ancestry, because as I mentioned, there was a Swedish village beside the German village in Russia, and there was an intermarriage of a family. So I can trace my ancestry back to Sweden and Swedish cuisine as well. So I've been, you know, sort of pursuing that this winter and learning more about that and the dishes that were very traditional in Sweden, and customs, food customs and that sort of thing. So it's something that I find really personal, and I enjoy doing, and it gives me a project and something to share with others.
I think I saw you tweet in December or November, there was a picture of a Swedish, traditional sort of Swedish cookie that was like a really tight S shape.
Oh, yeah. The Lusikatter. Those are very special little buns, sort of like the size of a cookie, but they are also a yeast dough, and they're flavored with saffron, so very special, because saffron is an expensive spice, especially in olden times. And they make them for St. Lucia Day, which is it's the day that falls, I can't remember exactly, but it falls around the solstice. But is it the 13th or the 12th of December now? It got pinned down to a date.
Can't recall.
But anyway, I made them for the first time, and they're so delightful.
They looked fantastic. And you made coconut macaroons that had been dipped in chocolate, but you called them something different. I think you called them by a German name.
Yeah, because it was a Swedish recipe. I'm trying to think now, it's called Kokos Macroner.
Yeah.
You know, it was a Swedish recipe for a coconut macaroon and dipped in chocolate, and it was
It sounds more charming when it has an ethnic name attached to it.
It does. They were really good. And I, because you and I are talking on Valentine's Day, fish cake for supper tonight. It's a really dense, gooey chocolate cake called Kaka. Gosh, now I'm going to forget the name. It's like a cocoa cake. Oh. Kaka smacker. No, I'm just thinking about. I'm failing in my Swedish vocabulary, but I'll remember the name, then I'll post it on my blog.
Yeah,
because it's a really great, just a fabulous and easy to. Here's another example of it's just the same old ingredients as everything else. It's got flour, eggs, cocoa powder, sugar, and yet you bake it in a totally different way. And you got a totally different cake. Love to contemplate all the different things that you can do with flour, sugar, eggs.
Do you find, like me, your time in the kitchen is almost meditative?
Yeah, quite often. Sometimes it's not when I'm making a mess of something, but because I'm experimenting, but absolutely. And I tend to fall into the things that I get into sort of these meditative grooves, and I remake the same thing over and over for a while until I realize that I'm sick of it. And then I find something else and I make it, but especially pie making and that sort of thing, or buns, those sorts of things, rolling cookies, the sorts of things that you have to get, you know, you're making them sort of piecework one at a time with your hands. I find that very comforting and meditative. Put the podcast on the radio on my phone and just listen to something and just slowly work through whatever it is I'm baking. It's a wonderful time for me. I do enjoy that a lot.
My stomach is literally growling. Literally.
I wish you could come over and have Swedish fika with me. Fika is the Swedish coffee drink. it's a little bit more ceremonial than just the, like I'm going for coffee. It's like you take a break, you sit down with someone, you have a conversation, you leave the world behind, and you have a coffee and something sweet. In Swedish offices, I discovered this is really quite sweet, I think, but the break room will be called the fika room because that's where you have your fika. So if you and I were together and we were doing this in person and we were just wrapping it up, I would say, okay, now come to sit at the table. I'm going to make some coffee and we're going to have a fika and eat some of my chocolate cake.
Well, unfortunately, we're stuck with a virtual table, and I'm just going to have to salivate over the photos that you tweet, because thus is the reality right now. And I know there are a lot of people that wish they could be sitting face-to-face on Valentine's Day or any day right now. It's just getting really, really tiresome. I'm ready to move on, and I hope that the vaccine comes sooner than later.
I think we're all ready to bust out of this. Definitely.
It's going to be one big old street party when finally we can say we're safely clear enough from this that we can take off our masks.
I hope that the restaurants and patios and picnic tables, I hope there's just this joyful rush out there to sit and share and eat with others.
Yeah, but until then, support your local restaurants. Go order takeout. I know you had takeout from, didn't you have something from Odla the other day?
You know what? I haven't had takeout from Odla, but I do go to their little shop. They have a shop there, and I've bought lard there and bacon and sausages and ice cream and eggs. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I like their little shop.
Yeah, we got to support these guys during the lockdown because it's a tough industry that's being hit really, really hard. Well, until we're able to do this face-to-face with coffee and something sweet, thank you so much. I'm so happy that I finally got to bring you into the family of guests in the podcast series. Thank you so much for spending some time with me over what is an absolutely delightful topic and an interesting and informative one.
Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast and for drawing such interesting, like having such interesting questions that really drew a lot of good thoughts out of me that I hadn't thought about. And it was really fun exploring those foods and those ideas with you.
So until next time, thank you, Amy Jo.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening. Music for Sascapes is provided by Saskatchewan-born singer-songwriter Jeffrey Straker. Sascapes can be downloaded from iTunes, Google Play, the Sascapes app for Android devices, and all of the other major podcasting apps. Stop by and say hi to us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Sascapes. I'd really appreciate it if you stop by iTunes and give us a review or star rating. That boosts the podcast series in the rankings and more people get to hear your stories. Now, if you know an individual, a group, a town that has a story to tell, I'd love to hear from you. Contact me and I'll let you know what's involved in sponsoring your own episode of Sascapes. There's no shortage of stories to be told here under the land of the living skies. So until next time. The Sascapes podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported in part by Kinexus. So, the next time you're stuck in traffic for a while, here's some things to think about instead of why is the car in front of you going so slow? Or if the car behind you is trying to hitch a ride on your bumper? What if your bank was committed to working with you to achieve your goals? And what if they cared enough to get to know you? And what if they weren't successful until you were? And what if your financial well-being drove everything they did? So come see why things are different at Kinexus. Stop by any branch to learn more about how Kinexus cares. Direct West is a proud sponsor of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. So is marketing getting in the way of running your business? Things like updating your Google listing, thinking of a headline for a billboard, or making sure your website is in good shape. That's where Direct West comes in. you can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com.